All right, tonight we're going to deal with the some of the very difficult questions that come out of the first chapter of Genesis, and titled this class 5769 versus 14 billion years. Obviously, attention, just by a little bit. So I asked you all to just to take a scan through the first chapter of Genesis here and raise some questions. Who'd like to jump on the bandwagon first? Dan Davidson.
Why does it seem like light was created twice?
Go ahead.
So obviously the first...
let there be light, first day.
Let there be light, discerning light and darkness.
Right.
Then we get there to the fourth day.
Fourth day, when there's the luminaries.
Let there be luminaries in the firmament of heaven.
Right. Excellent. Well, all right. You cannot... It appears that you... You cannot have light unless you have a sun. Suns are not created to the fourth day based on the account here.
Which so, brings the question why earth and water before stars and moons.
Right. Okay, good. Next.
On a similar note, when the earth and moon were created before that, how was time measured? Why didn't God create everything at once? Why did he need to create the steps of these outside of time?
Right, so, what's that? So your question?
My question is: if God is outside of time, then yeah. Why did He need days to do it, or how are those days measured, especially before the sun was created on the fourth day?
But I was saying the tools of counting time, which is the rotation of the Earth and the Moon and all these different. They're not. How do you have time without the ways of measuring time?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. A lot of that, they just did that. You have a fucking shot?
Actually, definitely on the others.
Other spectrum? Other spectrum,
yeah,
go ahead.
Of Michael's question. So it's just one day to create all the animals of the sea? It's just one day to create all the land?
Right, which gives the question, are these days 24-hour periods?
It's a day, 24 hours.
Okay, good question. Any other questions? All right, Kat, a fucking shot?
I get a little stuck on what God keeps saying, and it was good for some things. What does it mean when he's giving a stamp of approval?
Yeah, excellent. Obviously, he's going to do something. That could be good. And he created something, and he found it rather mediocre. For example, Hashem created Cable. Kind of mediocre, right? So, correct. Good question. And then at the end, the sixth day is Vayera Alchemical Kosher, something named Tov Me'od. It was... Very good. What's up with that? Okay, we're going to... Again, I'll try to squeeze all into an hour. I mean, obviously, there's a course. But again, I felt that... Remember, you guys asked us to do this. We're going to take the first step. I think I'll be able to give you a basic approach, which you could then develop on later on. All right, Shannon?
I don't know if this is really a question, but kind of what sticks out to me is like the phrase, and the divine presence covered upon the surface of the water.
Yes. What is it? The Ruach Elohim. Okay, go ahead. What's the question?
So did it stop hovering? Or, I mean, and how does the presence hover if God is supposed to be all encompassing and all around us?
Well, Hashem is not all around us because that makes him physical.
Yeah.
So the question is, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Okay, what does Ruach Elohim mean? Okay, good question.
Isn't
it just I'm not going to say. Okay, I'm going to be vague. Yes?
Was man, in fact, the last physical item created?
All right, so was man at the end of creation seems to be then the Adam and Chava created, correct? Right. Is that really? All right, so the question really is, I mean, the question of all the things is, what is the correlation between what occurred in time and space? Okay, what actually occurred if you had a time machine? And it seems to be as expressed by the Pesukim here. Is that is this supposed to be a accurate account of the unfolding of the universe? Okay. These are the basic questions. Okay, we're gonna get on into it. Also says Ar Tekdat Tovu, and the land was null and was void and Tovu, was it translated? Chaos, let's say. So, but if the land's not created till the third day, then how could the land be? If it's not there, how could it be in chaos? I mean, what is that really? So the questions will fly up. Now, Has anybody seen, seen the movie Inherit the Wind? It's an old movie, a 1960 old film, which basically depicted the Scopes Monkey Trial. Okay, so the Scopes Monkey Trial, just for everybody, just to refresh everybody's recollection, was a case in 1926 in Tennessee. After the thing called the Butler Act. What was the Butler Act? I will quote. That is forbidden. That in Tennessee, that is forbidden for any state-funded educational establishment, i.e. a public school, to teach any theory which denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead of them the man we had descended from a lower order of animals. Okay, that was what the Butler Act was. So immediately the ACLU wanted to file a motion against that, and a high school teacher named John Scopes taught a class, intentionally violated the class by the rule by teaching class on Charles Darwin's theory of evolution taken from the on the Origin of Species. Okay, thus violating. He of course gets busted for doing that. Okay. And then they had the ACLU hired, the top defense lawyer Clarence Darrow, and the state of Tennessee hired the no less than the 3-time presidential candidate, congressman, and former secretary of state William Jennings Bryan. Okay, these are two outstanding lawyers to fight out. The reality was not a non-case, because the reality was there was a law, he violated. And he was high. He had to pay the fine. Okay, but in the sidebar action was really the issue of Clarence Darrow poking fun at basically Christian fundamentalism, which takes that every word of the Bible is literally true, and all the questions you asked tonight and more were raised. So you maintain the world that you, Clarence Darrow says, you maintain the Bible is literally true. Yes. He had a number of state officials on the stand, and then he brought him into all these obvious contradictions, which the first chapter of Genesis is filled with. Okay, which we're doing tonight. So what I'm going to try to present to you, which is I'm going to say a approach to this question. This question is not a new question, and I'll tell you it's not. The only approach, I happen to like this approach, it's not my own approach, it's a learner from others, and you'll be the judge tonight, okay? So I'm going to take you back to a story that happened into a sukkah of mine about a couple years ago. I had a couple over, and I was getting to schmoozing, and they share with me that they had a fight. Couple having a fight? Never! Right? So what they shared with me, that they had a fight, both had gone to yeshiva. And the woman says, I don't believe that the biblical story is a literal account, and that the earth, in fact, is 69 years old. And her husband says, how do you say that? That's heresy. That was the opening gambit. I think we just finished the gefilte fish. We weren't even into the whole thing. Okay, so we had it was a fun time. Anyway, so we're going to deal with that issue. So as Jews, how do we deal with the story of racism? And do we agree or disagree with Christian fundamentalists? Okay, so basically you have to see there are two categories of questions you're going to encounter, which I think everybody has brought up here. One are the internal questions within the text. It says, he ordered to be light, day one. And then we see that the sun is not created till day three. That's an inherent contradiction. Usually, the sun is the source of light in our solar system. Okay, that's one category. And then you have external problems, certain questions from the sciences and other wisdoms. So I'm going to list a couple of the internal questions. So we mentioned how could the land be tohu vavohu in chaos when the land does not emerge till day three? How could there be light if there are no luminaries? How could there be day and night or night if there are no luminaries? And how can the water be above the firmament And what is a firmament? Okay, I don't know. It's a rakia. It's a below. It's above. I don't know. And, you know, so it's a very, very mysterious piece. And then let's go to a couple of external questions. These are just, you know, representative category. How can the Earth be 5769 years old when we have carbon dating on objects going back billions of years? Okay, we have trees that we count the zero, the rings going to back to 13,000 years. Hello. Okay, so that's a problem. You know what I mean? You can go drill down into some of the glaciers in the Arctic, and they have layers because, you know, you see every winter there's a new little, you know, gets compacted, but layer of snow. So if you just drill down, take a whole thing, you can count every single winter, and there are more than 5,769 winters. So you have these. Okay, well, there you go. It's all a lie. Okay.
Planted by aliens.
Right. All right. And then the next thing is that how can you have the universe be created in 6 days if you have modern cosmology having evidence that the Big Bang occurred close to 15 billion years ago? And furthermore, going back to the evolutionary aspect, how can you say that man was a separate creation if evolutionary theory points to the fact that we share 98% of the DNA of a gorilla and 92% roughly of a fruit fly? Okay, so hello. I mean, that's simply there. I mean, there is. Is that just a quinky dink? Okay, so. So that is that. Is that all right. So
these are the greatest questions.
Okay. We're all on the same page here. This is clear, right? Okay. So the first move is a Mishnah. We learn a little Mishnah. The Mishnah in Chagiga.
The first proof.
The first step in our development is a Mishnah, and I'll read it to you. It says, "Ein dorshin ba'arayis b'shlosha." One may not have an engaged conversation about the sexual prohibition with more than three people. Why? Because, okay, I'm just going to say that. And then, v'lobe mice of rachis b'shnaim, and you cannot have a public lecture about the act of creation with more than two people. V'lobe mice of merkava, not on the act of the creation, which is the first chapter of Ezekiel, with one person. And if it's only with one person, unless he is a wise person and discerning from his own mind. Okay, so I'll just give you the whole fact here. The discussion of the sexual, talking about detailed detailed class with lots of about the sexual prohibitions is that what the halakha is afraid of, that there's going to be a sidebar conversation. By the way, this is more of a master class. I'm not talking about a general basic class. What's going to happen? That a posek, it's like we'll call it a smicha class, an ordination class. So you have the rabbi, chief rabbi, talking to the students, and if they get into a dialogue, and those other two get into a dialogue, then the two people are going to talk amongst themselves, not hear everything, and when it comes to give a halachic psak, since people are very naturally inclined towards sexuality, that's, we are all instinctual beings, he's not going to remember clearly, and he's going to distort the halacha. So in areas of that has to be done with either more than three or only with three. That's an argument among the sources, not our focus. But interesting, it says you cannot have a public class with a teacher with more than two students about the act of creation, which of course puts into specter our class here. We have more than two people here tonight. So what's going on here? So the Rambam, when he was 21, his first great work was the commentary on the Mishnah. At age 30, he wrote the Mishnah Torah because he felt that wasn't sufficient. So he basically says like this, that the reason why, I mean, you should ask the basic question, why is there a prohibition about learning Torah at all? Torah is, you know, it's a mitzvah to learn Torah. It should be the more the merrier. Fill up the stadium. Have a Yankee stadium cheer. Wouldn't that be great? So the bottom line is that that's true for everything except for a few areas of the Torah. He says that these topics, which is Maisa Bereishis, the act of creation, and Maisa Merkava, the act of the divine chariot, are very, very deep. It's called the secrets of the Torah. And it's natural for everybody to desire that knowledge. And therefore, people who do not have the proper training will be drawn to the subject matter. And essentially, they're going to get information which will, to use the modern parlance, will rock their world, and not in a positive way. Okay? The bottom line is there's a secret to the Torah, and there's secrets for a reason. Not because the Torah is inherently elitist. It's because you don't teach a first grader calculus, because in that case they're not going to understand it. But, and nor does one describe to a 11-year-old, if you are a rabbi and a pastor, if that the, let's say, a relative died in a gruesome car accident, you're not going to share with that 11-year-old the gory details exactly how the person was dismembered on the Northern State Parkway. Not because they can't intellectually understand it, because emotionally that would be shattering to their world. So you have to respect a person's psyche and understand it. You have to be sensitive as an educator. So one thing is, so therefore, you have to make one deduction from this Mishnah. This is your basic move. If this first chapter has essentially a plain meaning, a pshat meaning, really, there would be no prohibition. But really, the pshat is not really the pshat. There really is no simple meaning of the first chapter of Genesis. And therefore, it's not essentially a literal depiction of what occurred. Okay, in other words, do you see the deduction I'm making? I'm going to say that again. In other words, if, let's say, for example, we're going to learn the story of Avram, right? So Avram is traveling down to Mizraim. The story, we have to, there's no prohibition about teaching that anywhere. And you take that as being, you know, a literal account, and of course with more advanced ideas embedded in it. Here, in a certain sense, there is no literal account here.
It's an
just
illusion?
Like what?
It's an illusion.
No, it's not an illusion. It's essentially written in the format. What book in the Tanakh also has no plain meaning?
What book?
Go ahead, Esther.
No, not true.
Sorry. Right.
You're warm, though. It is a Megillah, though.
Not
Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, on a basic literal level, is a love poem.
Right. So that's okay. A shot, supposed.
It does, in a certain sense, not really, because we're talking about
non-existence.
No. The essence of it is really a metaphor to the depicting certain aspects of the relationship between Bnei Israel and the Shekhinah. Okay, that's really what's going on there. Using romantic metaphors. But it's not a pshat that, you know, Shlomo Melch is talking about women with large breasts. Okay? But if you read the text... Okay, so that's okay. I'm just saying that's
okay.
That's a conversation. But the bottom line... I'm just giving this another example where... I'm not saying there's... I mean, in order to know the metaphor, if you have a mashal, you have a nimshal. But essentially what's really happening is in the nimshal level. So to hear, what's happening here is not on the surface, but on the subsurface. Now, the class we're having tonight is not, we're not going to penetrate into deep secrets here. Very simple reason why. Because I don't know them. Okay, so I can't give you what I do not know. Simple thing. But I'm going to remove certain ideas, certain problems that emerge based upon trying to take a literalistic approach. It's not saying it's not true. Every word is precious and true. But it doesn't mean that you can access the meaning on the first level. I'm going to give you a basic level meaning, understanding here, some of the terms, and give you a basic way to handle the first chapter. But really should, in a certain sense, know that with him, again, it's people on a very high level supposed to be going to it. Now, just give you another a fact. I want to throw out another point about here. Rabbi Chait, my rabbi, who was ordained me, pointed out to me, and the responsum, which is, you know, questions and answer responded by great rabbis in the past. One of the great people were the Rashba. The Rashba, like Shlomo ben Aderet, was a student of the Ramban, Nachmanides. great man. And he wrote thousands of responses, Shelo to Tshuvot. People asked him questions, he wrote them answers, and they put them all into big books. Okay? You can actually, and he is, and as a writer of responses, he's, you know, a major source of Torah knowledge. In his first volume, in the ninth Teshuvah, he states, and I'm going to quote you, "All Chachamim, from the Chachmei HaTorah HaChasidim, which is the great wise and righteous or pious rabbis, when they would see philosophic or scientific ideas that were correct in their eyes, and then would encounter psukim, verses in the Tanakh, that suggested the opposite, they would take them as a mashal. They would take that verse as being a metaphor, provided they did not relate to any mitzvah or a nevuah, a specific prophecy stated by a prophet. Do you understand what I'm saying? Which means that if, let's say, the great Chacham accepted a certain idea, and they saw a verse on the narrative of the Tanakh that seemed to go against that, they would take that verse as being a metaphor. Okay? So the bottom line is that we as Jews do not take a literalist approach to the Tanakh. We take one person phrased very nicely, we take a textual approach to the Tanakh. It means that we value the every word of the Tanakh, but you have to understand it within a certain context, and we have an oral tradition that gives us guidance when we take things literally, when we take not literally. Eye for an eye, there never was a time in Jewish history when a person would purposely gouge out a person's eye, that they would take a person and gouge out their eye as an act of compensation to the other person. Never did that. It was always financial compensation. But the Torah wrote them that way to convey an additional idea, which the Rambam and the Mor Avuchim discuss at point. All right, Jesse.
Was this verse, though, ever taken literally?
What? The first chapter of Genesis?
Yeah.
Yes. Because until modern science, you had no reason to think otherwise.
Exactly. But so then, because we have this oracle...
No. Hold on up. Let me explain. In other words, let me be very specific. Maimonides, for example, he did not have a problem with the time. I'll be very specific. He didn't have a scientific problem, with the 5769 date. But he never accepted the first chapter. Nobody accepted the first chapter as not being having a source of profound, deep secrets. That's a Mishnah. A Mishnah is a text of the oral law, and that clearly indicates that what's lurking here is not on the surface, but below the surface. And in fact, not only that, there's a big fence around this chapter, really, to learn it in a sophisticated way. Because if you're not ready, you're going to distort it, and it'll be bad.
But there are a lot of like a lot of the parshiyot that we learn, we think that there's many levels of meaning.
Right.
We still believe that the text itself has like the plain meaning.
Yes.
And then, so was it believed that this text had that this was the plain meaning of the text was reality?
No, the plain text is, the key thing is here is that the plain text is not the essential show. In other words, when we're learning our regular Chumash, there is an idea of the verse is a mikra yotzei nepshuta. The verse does not go beyond. There's a significance on the first level, and then there's additional strata.
Right.
It's like you're doing an excavation.
Right.
You're doing an excavation here. What this mission is pointing out to that the essential action is on the surface.
My question is just: Are we now trying to?
Are we trying to retrospectively change?
Or just understand it based on our modern interpretation.
No,
our modern.
Because I'm going to get if I had a more expanded time, I'm going to show you. First of all, the Mishnah is from the year 200.
Right.
Okay, but I'll give you more points that point out. I mean, I'm going to try to get to one of them. A midrash about Eor. Fascinating. I'll just try this. So again, midrashim are written in the first 500 years of the Common Era. Again, before there was any kind of the scientific issues.
Mm-hmm.
Again, clearly pointing out, I'll give you, not taking this as a literal phenomenon. The Meforshim, Rashi, the Ramban, all in their own way, do not take a literalist. Nobody takes a, my basic point is, nobody takes a literalistic perspective. Now, it doesn't mean that they could not maintain that God could have created the world in 6 days. Although Rashi indicates it seems everything was created on the first day and then evolved from that. Yeah, the Ramban, Nachmanides, it's a very, you know, it's a lot of source material here, but I'm just trying to give you a little overview. The basic move here is that the questions that Christian fundamentalists struggle with are not questions for us. Because we're not bound to, we have a tradition that's not, essentially not a literal text. Now, on the Ten Commandments says, do not murder, that's a literal text. That is an oral law claim. What is murder? You know what I'm saying? That's a very important distinction. In fact, I'm going to move on, extend it further. In addition to the Rashba, the great commentator Sanjigon says, you basically assume a text is literal unless you are, for four reasons, taken not literally. One of which is that it goes against, it's inherently impossible. Yad Hashem, God's arm. God's not physical, he can't have an arm, therefore it's a metaphor referring to God's power. Divrei Torah L'shon B'nei Adam, the Torah speaks in the manner of man, which means ascribing God human attributes, just for our understanding, but God is not human, and not you having any physicality whatsoever. It's a metaphor. Mark Berger.
What are some of these items that the Christian fundamentalists struggle with, right?
Say it again?
What do the Christian fundamentalists struggle with?
They think the world, I've heard Christian fundamentalists maintain the earth. The earth itself is 6,000 years old. Now, I will tell you, I've heard religious Jews maintain the same thing. There is a, I've heard this position. Personally, I think it's laughable. I'm being honest here. My opinion. That God made it old. And God made, and I'm not going to mention on it, made the earth look old.
Oh.
So, I have a tremendous, I'm not going to mention who that's ascribed to. Rabbi Slifkin, he wrote a great book about the issue of creation, and it deals and has a lot of the source material that I'm alluding to, most of it in his book, and it's a good read. I recommend.
Is that position that you mentioned, is that any source material behind it, or is it just one random sect?
Is it
one sect?
Was
a
thought
from?
You mean
textual? Right. That's the position of the last Baba Shrevi. You know, he writes about that. I personally maintain that position. My opinion, again, I'm going to underline the word opinion, I find that not defensible. Okay? And I will give you, within the sources, to provide an alternate an understanding here. But the first move here is not to take the first 6 days being a literal account, because the Torah is not here to teach us science or cosmology. It's here to teach us fundamental philosophical lessons about how to live as humans. Okay, that's the basic point. But I want to get to some. So basically, my basic solution is that the word "aretz" by the word "land" does not mean land. Choshech, darkness, does not mean literal darkness. Mayim does not mean water, and Or does not mean optical light. Okay, that's my basic move here. So is everybody with me so far? Okay? Now, what I'd like to do is give you basically an overview of the entire chapter defining 7 terms. And this is actually coming from my curriculum that I had for high school students. I worked together with another MG rabbi who was here last year, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, who was the architect of this. We worked together literally many times to try to shrink this thing down. So again, you shouldn't wait till you're 30-something hearing this, but you should be when you're 14 learning about this. Especially if you're going to, after lunch, you're going to go to biology, and you're going to go to all these various classes in science, you're going to encounter modern ideas. Okay? So basically, I want to define 7 terms. One is a term of, you can just write this down. First term is system. Second term is tohu vavohu, which is chaos. Tohu vavohu is in the second verse. How do they translate tohu vavohu? Null and void, what are they called? Nothingness and void, what are they called in the second verse? They say astonishingly empty. Okay. Tohu vavohu, it's very hard. Okay, so I'm going to define that term. Third term is or. Okay, what that term or refers to, vayhi or, and there was literally light. Next, we're going to talk about tov ma'od. Fourth term is tov, which was Kant's question. What does tov mean? Good. It was, and God saw it and it was good. And then the sixth day, tov ma'od.
Sorry, okay. What was the third term?
Third term was or.
And then tov?
Tov, and then tov ma'od. And then the sixth term is Tselem Elohim. Okay? The divine image. We defined that earlier this year, but we'll put into the whole package here. And last term is Malacha. Okay? Which, of course, you have by Shabbat. But God is doing Malacha here. Okay? Well, let's get to one thing at a time. All right, we can move this? All right, so let's take the first term. You need to know, as far as we understand the first chapter of Genesis, you need to know the term system. What is system? System is defined as parts organized to cooperate in accomplishing one goal. I'll repeat that again. A system is defined as parts organized to cooperate in accomplishing one goal. Let me give you an example. A park is a system whose parts, swings, seesaws, merry-go-rounds, slides, ropes, are organized to cooperate in accomplishing one goal, which is play, recreation, fun. A school is defined as a system whose parts, teachers, students, classroom, books, pens, notebooks, erasers, are principals, are organized to cooperate in accomplishing one goal, learning or education, hopefully. Last example, subway system. Define a system whose parts, trains, stations, tickets, conductors, rails, are organized to cooperate in accomplishing one goal. Public transportation. Public transportation, not just for the masses, okay? So that's system. So that's a very important point. So let's go to the Pesukim. Everybody open up your Chumashim now. Let's take it out to... Okay, who would like to read the first five psukim, please? First five verses, all right, Michael Dodes.
In the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth, when the earth was astonishingly empty, with darkness upon the surface of the deep, and the divine presence hovered upon the surface of the waters, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated between the light and the darkness. God called to the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day.
Okay, so we're going to, you know, in due respect to the article translation, we're going to get a little more sophisticated understanding here. So, being that Aris here, and the Rishonim take the point, Aris is not referred to land, but what the key thing would be is Aris would be the primordial matter before the laws of nature fully take effect. Okay? In other words, to put into a cosmological point, if you're dealing with, assuming we're going to take the Big Bang Theory, so Big Bang Theory is that all matter in the universe was concentrated in one singularity, one dot. Interesting, the Ramban has a similar idea. Nachmanides. Okay? And then from there, there's in one moment, there's an explosion. Okay? And the laws of nature, as we understand, as physics understand today, only happens like a number of milliseconds into the explosion. But before, there's no laws of nature. There's nothing orderly right now. There we call, tovavo. Tovavo is what? Is that the entire system is completely disorganized. You have matter, you have matter going here, going there, you have no laws, it's completely a mess. Okay? All right, so it says in the Aretz, and primordial matter was tohu vavohu, was complete chaos. It was disorganized, all the parts, which is hydrogen and oxygen and all the different parts, are just all over the place. Okay? This will be in the literally first milliseconds of the universe. Yes?
You said Muhammad is not land.
It's not land. It's the primordial matter, which means it's the elements before they're even organized into being elements in a nice organized fashion. If you look at the periodic table, you have the nucleus, and you have electrons and protons organized in a beautiful, harmonious way based on God's lawful world, organize themselves around the nucleus. This is before that happened, which happened in the first literally moments of that whole process. Okay. Now, interestingly, it's a fundamental of Judaism that we maintain that first singularity, that first material something, God brought into being out of nothingness. We call it Yesh Me'ayin. Okay, that's part of our tradition. The Torah does not openly say that. It just says, it just starts. Yesh, something, Me'ayin, from nothingness. Versus Yesh Me'yesh, something from something. We have something from nothing. Okay? The Torah does not even talk about that. They're talking about the beginning process when there is already a something. Okay? Just as you should know, Plato maintained, he maintained that God coexisted with some primordial matter, and he caused a creation to emerge out of that primordial matter. We do not agree with him. We maintain that there was God brought into being that primordial matter. Okay, just giving a little, just a little bit, just a little tasteful here and there. So Tohu Vohu, what's an example of Tohu Vohu? You're visiting New Orleans
after the earthquake,
after the Katrina. Right, and there you go out there, and you see there's a pickup truck in a tree, and you see a house floating down the bayou, right, or whatever they call it down there, right. Alright? Or very simply, you buy a bike which requires assembly, and you get a box and it has 8,000 pieces. That is Tohu Vohu. Disorganized parts of the system. Okay? So right now all the elements are there, but they need an organizing force. Okay. So, by definition, the choshech, the darkness here, is not lacking of light. It has nothing to do with light. Okay, I'm not going to point exactly what that is. And I'm not going to go into the Ruach Elohim right now. I'm going to go to the Yior. Okay? The Ruach Elohim is the spirit of Hashem hovering on the water. Again, how's there water if there's no earth? I mean, it's all... Okay, so I'm gonna leave that mysterious. What is the or here? It's not optical light. Here's a key principle here. Or to put it very simply, the Or is the light of divine wisdom. So what is Vayior? So Vayior is by definition clearly not optical light. There is no sun. What we're dealing with here is that Or here is the divine wisdom. And it's the wisdom that provides the design and blueprint to organize all this chaotic matter. Okay? In other words, the organizing force of the universe is God's wisdom that makes the entire universe lawful. If you go any part of the universe, you will find gravity, based upon the same principle that you find right here on the 11th floor at MG. Gravity, now of course it's stronger and lighter depending on all the factors, but the equation, the reality of the law of gravity and of sound and all the forces and factors in the universe is present. So Hashem said, "Let there be light. Let there be a wisdom that is now going to, if you will, organize this chaos of primordial matter into a organizing factor, which we call a blueprint. In other words, I have a bunch of lumber, I got steel, I got concrete, I got nails, I got this. I don't got a house. But then comes the architect, hands the blueprint to the contractor. He brings the ore, the organizing design, and hopefully the contractor, the general, you know, whoever's in charge, will organize all the guys to make that matter, i.e. the lumber, the nails, the concrete, based upon this plan, these principles, into a building. Okay? Yes, Shannon.
I don't know if I'm jumping ahead.
Yes.
Then how does light become day?
Okay, okay, so the we'll get to the question. Okay, we'll fill in all the stuff. Now, so the next thing is that you have is now it says that God made ore, and there was ore, and God's vayar Elohim at the ore, kito. He saw that it was good. What does good mean? What does tov here mean? What does he mean by it's good?
It's starting to operate, like it's starting to...
It's as intended.
An improvement.
You basically have a partial organization of the parts. Let's go back to our building metaphor here. You pass by a building site, and you see they've laid the foundations, all the concrete, and you see the steel beams already in place. So you would say, that's toe. In other words, the skeleton of the entire building is present. But they don't have, is it a building? Can I go to the 11th floor? I cannot. But you see clearly that there's been a discernible stage has been done. Do you know what I'm saying? So what's happening throughout the creation story is that every discernible stage, when there's a partial development of the parts, that's Tov.
It's a mark of completion, basically.
Say again?
It's a milestone
for that piece. Yes. A developmental stage has been completed. Like with a child, the child is born, the child hits, then he goes through, he hits, well, there's many stages, but let's say, hits puberty, then adolescence, etc. You know, various stages of development. Okay? Clear changes. Yes, Jen?
How come it doesn't say for the other parts it was good? And how come...
Excellent. So very good, very good. So, but you now have the tool to answer that question, because you notice that by Yom Sheni, there's no mention of Tov. But on Yom Shlishi, how many Tovs does it get?
By Mayim.
All right, very good. Why? So what do you see happens? So what happened in day two?
It was a one-piece thing. Monday, Tuesday.
Well, I mean, okay, there were necessary stages of development, even though there was a lot of work going on and discernible discrete quantity of work, but they did not have what? A system, a part of a system did not come into being. This way, which is, let's say, the water or the earth system, whatever it is. Do you know what I'm saying? So the job was not done.
Yeah.
You know, for example, you see a building, there's walls in the roof, but there's no electrical, there's no plumbing. So, you know, all right. Progress has been made, but you don't got the whole package. Okay? Alright? So, I mean, you know, if you put the foosball table into the game room, but the whole room is unpainted, is that, it's Tov. It's not, you know, we're not done. We're not, we're going to get to, not Tov mode. Alright? Now, let's go into. I'm gonna go to the key thing. What's happening here? What is happening here? If you at Hashem at the end, go to Shabbat for a moment, chapter 2, page 10 here. Let's read verse. Let's first read verse 2 and 3, please. Okay, guys, who'd like to read it, please? All right, Jess?
Starting by the seventh day?
Yes.
On the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he abstained on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because on it he abstained from all his work which God created to make.
Okay, so here, God's doing this malacha. And then he does it. So for how many days does he do the malacha?
Six
days. Or so metaphorically, what is God functioning as here?
Us.
Okay, but not just any us, but a specific kind of
person. Creator.
What?
A creator,
but what kind of creator?
CEO.
True. CEO, okay, it's true, he's CEO. He's like a contractor. You know what I mean? Like you say, I want a deck. I speak to Anthony. Anthony, how many days was the deck? Been 6 days. You sure? I mean, it's even five. They're talking days, right? So this was the universe was a six-stage development. Malacha, what is Malacha? Now put it all together. What is Malacha? It's using an idea, which we'll call the or, taking all the material parts, which is the aretz, the primordial matter, and organizing into what?
A system.
Very good. That's it. That's malacha. And that's why it was true for Shabbat. Shabbat is, I have a steak, I have a design. I'm thinking grilled steak. Yummy. And I'm thinking, I'm gonna grill the outside, and I'm gonna put the steak onto the cooler part of the grill, so I don't have it rare, but medium rare. You know. So I have my design of ultimate steak. I slap that baby on the grill. All right. And I have my design in my mind. I have my art, I have my material object, which is the steak. And I have my tool called the grill. God does not need tools. His will apparently does the job. So the material universe, which came into being, the aretz, he brought that into being. He has the or to organize it into a developmental stage. And at the end, he ceases his malacha. God, as ultimate contractor, is done. And then on the sixth day, what does he do? He stops. And he reflects upon the beauty of the system. Okay? Yes?
Every other time he created a system, he said it was good. But this time, when he created Shabbos, he said that
When he finished the 6 days, what did he say?
It's very good.
Now, why does he say Tov Ma'od? What does Tov Ma'od mean?
The system's completed.
But all the subsystems are now harmonized into one living biosystem or cosmic system. All right, you have everything working together here.
So Shabbos is not a system, then?
Shabbos is not... He doesn't say that afterwards. Then, there's a separate day added on here to where after he ceases it to reflect upon it. He blesses it. He makes it unique. But really, the day is really a day where we reflect upon the creation. And, that's why it's the idea of mitzvah to learn on Shabbat. It's to reflect upon his creation. All right, that's why he said later on in Shemot, Ki Sisa, God ceased by Nefash and he became refreshed. But that thing refers to him looking at the universe and reflecting it on the beauty of that creation. Okay, and we do the same thing. Either through the Torah, the creation for humans, or the universe itself. Okay, so that's the totality of the whole situation. Now we have one more thing. Tzelem Elohim, part of the creation of man, was man was made, there's a man, and there's a Tzelem Elohim part. What is that? We discussed that. So Tzelem Elohim is the non-physical part of us, which has the ability to appreciate the aura. In other words, the Tzelem Elohim is a metaphysical part of man that can perceive God's wisdom as it courses through the universe and the Torah and the whole thing. Okay, that's really the... and then you can see the malacha, you can see the or in his malacha of the universe. So basically, to put this is the totality. I'm going to, if you want me to summarize the essence of Judaism into one sentence or less, coming from the first chapter of Genesis, if you would like that. Is basically is where man. So what really is the true good based upon man's design? Based upon the entire story of race itself, it's a little bit challenging, but I'm going to. Is basically, man is at his perfection when he's living a lifestyle where he's using his tzelem Elohim to see the ore, we use all the metaphors of Rashi's, in Hashem's malacha, and see how it expresses his tov ma'odness, if you will. Appreciating Hashem's tov ma'odness of the malacha through the ore. Perceiving the ore. Now we see perceive his ore in two levels. There's the ore, there's the wisdom that's from the Torah, and there's the wisdom that's manifest in the cosmos, in the laws of nature. Okay, there's two sources of appreciation, two realms of appreciation. Okay? When man is designed, when man is doing that, that's man at his peak. Because we have a special tool that could do that, called the Tzelem Elohim. Has the ability, in contrast to a gorilla, and this goes back to our question, even though we share 98% of the same DNA as a gorilla, we are qualitatively different than the gorilla for only one reason. Not for our physicality, but rather because we have a Tzelem Elohim.
Is it the Neshama?
As the Neshama, Tzelem Elohim, they're all the same, they're synonyms. Nefesh, Tzelem Elohim, Neshama is all the same.
So using Tzelem Elohim to perceive the light,
the ore, which is manifest in the malacha of Hashem, and perceiving how in fact it is systematic in a system of his system of Tov. Now, this goes back into, and this really goes into our conversation, Shema. Shema, when I accept that I am part of Hashem's system of Tov, his systems, for example, I want to live my own Tov system where I can eat whatever I want and there's no consequences. I can spend what I want and there's no consequences. I can do any kind of crazy behavior and there are no consequences. That's in my imaginary Tov system. And then there's Hashem's Tov system. The system has a reality as it is, with the big R. Okay? And that really, so our job is to perceive the reality of the system of Tov that Hashem created, accepting God's sovereignty, and not try to create in our, and not fall back in our illusionary world. That really goes back to what the first verse of Shema is all about, trying to reconnect to that. And that basically is the main point, if you will, the most basic of basic points of the first chapter of Genesis. Yes?
I mean, just on a technical point, what's the 5, 7, 6, 9 refer to then?
Okay, so 5, 7, 6, 9 can refer to when Adam HaRishon existed. The first 6 days of creation could have taken 4 billion years, whatever the earth is. That's not a problem. And I'm not talking about 24-hour days, but talking about 6 stages of development. Right. Now, this is, by the way, this approach is taken, I'm going to give you the names. The Rambam, the Rambam views this as, you know, that there's I think the Mishnah points out that it's not a literal phenomenon. Okay? And that that you don't have to take these days being, the point is not 24 hours. Stages of development. Okay? Just to see that there is a wisdom governing the universe, that man is part of that system, that in fact is Tov Ma'od, there's a goodness to the universe, if you will, and that we fit, and we have to see we are part of that. Okay, we're gonna go to Kat.
So you're saying that when we say the Shema, we're accepting like the yoke of heaven, and
yes,
we have to accept our state of reality. Then this is where this comes in, where we're realizing we're part of a whole system.
We're part of Hashem's Bria, so not in our own imaginary world.
So we're part. Okay. Oh, so the whole system is together. Okay.
Right. We have a rightful place in Hashem's kingdom of the universe. We have a place there. Our natural tendency, our imagination, is to pull ourselves out of that. We're not part of it. We are in a special world. We're in the Pete Rosenthal world.
So.
In a special bowl. At least I am.
It's not my own blueprint for anything.
Exactly. It's aligning my design with his design. That's tefillah. Tefillah is the activity of aligning my design with his design. The design of the Tov Ma'od of the universe. Okay? That's basically the main point of Judaism, in a nutshell. And that's why it's in the first chapter, because where else do you think the main idea is going to be? In the middle? No. It's in all. Everything really can go back to the first chapter of Genesis. Okay? So, we have to see that if the world without his wisdom would, without the or, would go back to what? Tohu vohu. Absolute chaos. And we see evil.
Without his wisdom?
Yes. And that could be, whether it be in the material thing or in the civilizational world. When you see there's war, you're looking at Tohu vohu because people can't get along because they're battling illusions, which should be the most prominent, which should be the most prominent principle here. The Hezbollah field maintains that we should be in a caliphate and that the Israel is a thorn in their side and they should be flattened. It's their vision of the universe. That's their blueprint. That's their aura. Their false aura. And et cetera. Yes, Jen.
Can you take this off tape? What I'm about to ask you.
In conclusion, the bottom line is that the and this is, I believe, is the position of the Ralbag, not Gershonides and Maimonides, who point out that this is not really, and I believe the Mishnah and Midrashim, that do not look at the first chapter as a literal description of what occurred in time and space. The Torah is not expressing that. And if in reality, as we have compelling material, scientific proof to accept the fact that the universe is in fact is 14 billion years. It's 14 billion years old, and that's it. You know what I mean? And the only thing where we will disagree specifically with, say, biological evolutionist is with the idea that man is just pure, is a sophisticated animal. It is a fundamental truth that man does have tzelem Elokim. That is where there's a major line in the sand. And this was not a Jewish concept. You know Descartes, of course, you're all familiar, believe there is a soul, which, that there is man as a part that does do abstract thought. This is not philosophically or in the secular world is not really in vogue right now, that idea. They want to reduce man to be a sophisticated animal, but we are maintaining that man is beyond that. We maintain that man is fundamentally superior to that. And man does have a neshama, a nefesh, tzelem Elokim, that can perceive Hashem's or, which is external to the material world. So that, I'm just giving you a basic approach. I think this gives you a basic a foundation point. I'll just give you a little touch. When he has by or, the Ralbag quotes Midrash from Tehillim that says, what was the or? What was the or? What's or? So one idea is the or that Hashem created was only that he perceived. So again, if it's optical light, it should be able to be, everybody who has eyes can see it. What it means is a light that only Hashem can see. It's the light of wisdom. It's in the realm of the metaphysical world, the purely spiritual world, where it's not subject to an eye. You know what I'm saying? Rashi brings down Midrashim. I'll just give you a quick one. What's the light? I'll just throw you out a little Rashi here, a little Rashi action. Rashi quotes all these Midrashim, which are very, very difficult to perceive. Rashi quotes, and God saw that the or was good, and he separated. He said, even this we need the words of the Midrash. Hashem saw she'ina kedai l'shtamesh bo rishayim. It's not good for the wicked to work with, and he separated for the righteous, for the asid level, for the future, either for the Messianic era or for the world to come. again, if you're taking the or is optical light, what do you mean? He doesn't want the wicked people to use it, but rather it's for the righteous to the world to come. Clearly he's talking about a light of illumination. There's certain ideas that gets into the wrong hands of people can be destructive. So again, you see that the Midrashim are taking that the or is not an optical light emerging from a sun or any kind of star, but rather it's a wisdom that emerges from Hashem, that emanates from Hashem. All right, this is what I've given you sort of a quick run through some of the basic points here. I think you have a basic perspective to be able to deal with some of the glaring questions and approach. I think that is true to Torah and as well as true to science. There are more questions here. Again, this will be a course, but to shrink it down to 1 hour, I think it's the best I could do. So I'll take a break.